start. Are you ready? Okay.
Yes, it has started.
Okay, so now it's started. Okay. So I wanted to say a couple of things. One is we are going to have another call in July at the same time and the same numbers. It'll be July 2nd, which is a Tuesday. And our speaker, a presenter, will be Roger Sakacy, and he has something called the Technology Legacy, and he's going to explain what that is and how it works. So if you're interested, on Tuesday, July 2nd, same time, same numbers, he'll be our presenter. And then next, I do want to remind anybody who is interested, we do have a retreat, which is coming up September 15th through 21 in Rocky Bottom. And it's going to be, we are getting quite a few applicants, and we do limit those who can come, so we have a good experience for everyone. So if you know people are interested, they should apply by contacting me very soon. Okay, so those are my announcements. Does anybody have any other thing? Okay, and
Maria, can you please repeat the conference for the 11th Technology What?
It's July 2nd. It's called the Technology Legacy Project. It's July 2nd, a Tuesday.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Okay.
Podcast download failed. Not enough space on internal memory.
Oh, dear.
It's okay. It's okay. My VictorStream is downloading podcasts, and I'm not sure how to stop that. So it's...
Anyway. Okay, but otherwise it's okay.
Yes,
okay.
It's working.
We seem to have technical issues sometimes lately with our calls, but anyway.
Maybe we need a legacy.
Yeah. Maybe.
All you have to do is not connect to the internet, and those can't come down.
How do I unconnect from the internet right now?
Yeah. Oh, well, I thought it was the middle button on the top, right above the numbers.
This is what I like.
The one in the middle at the top?
Not the diamond, not the square, but the round one.
Okay. It just went...
Airplane mode on.
Okay, so I pushed it, it went to beep. We'll see. So go ahead, Ruth.
Okay, so we'll go ahead. So, Piggy, you're here?
I am.
You are here. Oh goodness, what can we say? Peggy's done so many different things. She's a longtime Federationist, and she's going to tell us how she got started on this project, which she calls the Blind History Lady. And so we're going to hear from her how she does her research, what she does, and how she got started. And so we'll just let her tell us whatever she has to say. So welcome, Peggy, and I'm glad you're on the call, and thank you so much for being our speaker this afternoon.
Well, thank you for asking. And as a bunch of you were coming on, I recognized a lot of you. So some of you maybe heard a little bit of this spiel before, but it's hard to hear it twice. Especially if your memory is getting bad like mine. I have started this project I call the Blind History Lady, and I began it about 6 years ago when basically Curtis sort of told me to either stop collecting all this junk because we were tired of moving it or had to do something with it. I've been collecting stories, interviews, newspaper clippings, books, about blind people, not the Helen Kellers or the Louis Brailles, but the people such as John Swearingen, or my favorite, only because he was my first, what I call my blind ancestors, Thomas David Shaw. And I started collecting them because of him. I was given the task of cleaning out the file cabinets and boxes of the NFB of Minnesota as we were moving into new space from the Home for the Blind. And I was set, and I was told, well, you'll know more of these old people's names than we will, because I'd grown up in the blind community all my life. I grew up in Fargo, North Dakota, where I knew the blind rug weavers, the blind door-to-door salesmen, the blind janitors, and so on. And I was always a little bit ashamed of them because they had those stereotypical blind guy jobs. They didn't try for anything better. But what I wasn't realizing at the time, and I do now, so part of my Blind History Lady project is sort of an apology to a lot of those blind guys in the past that I made fun of, is they were actually pioneers. These guys were working. They were not on public assistance. They were supporting their families. And for their time period, they were the blind people who were making a difference. So I'm cleaning out the Minnesota files, the NFB of Minnesota files, and I'm pitching here and pitching there, just reading a little bit here, a little bit there. And every so often I'd stop to read an entire letter or document. And the letter I chose that made the impact was this one from about 1923, where Frank Hall, one of our founding members, was talking about meeting with, quote, our blind congressman, unquote. And I thought to myself, what blind congressman? You know, because I was in my late 20s, so I knew it all, you know. You know how young people can be. And I figured I should know who that was. So I read on and found the letter that was attached to Thomas Shaw. Put it aside and kept going. After I'd finished that project, I went down to the public library and talked to a librarian who promptly pulled out a whole big picture file of Thomas David Shaw. Well, that was nice. I took a few copies of it. And what actually appeared in the Braille Monitor when I wrote an article about Congressman and then later Senator Shaw. Mostly what I was doing was collecting articles, getting things from libraries. I can see some, so it helps a lot to be able to read the things in library files that way. As the years progressed, I became involved with genealogy and started working on my family tree, which is how I came across the idea, these are all my blind ancestors, you know. So my tree looks a little bit differently because Thomas David Shaw is at the bottom of my tree and then the rest branches out from there. We don't have the same lineage that you would if you took a DNA test, but these still are our blind ancestors that we're never told about. For example, most people do not realize that Shaw was one of five blind congressmen. He was also one of two blind U.S. senators. We don't read about them very often at all. And if it hadn't been for Vice President Gore, we probably would have lost all information about his, I think their great uncle or something like that, Thomas Pryor Gore, who was in the Senate at the same time as Shaw. We are told often we're the first blind person to try something. And that's usually not the case because nobody has bothered to sit down and research us. That was another driving force. So while I'm doing my family genealogy, I got onto Ancestry.com and discovered that that site is fairly accessible until you get into the nitty-gritty. And then it all depends.
Tom Anderson?
So with the Ancestry.com, I got started with that. Also, I had started out with a company called NewspaperArchives.com that was actually fairly accessible, and in two-thirds of the cases, I could actually read the newspapers. They've now changed their format. It is not accessible. It's even very difficult for me to search in there at times, which is really sad because they had a good thing going for a while, and I was able to pull a lot of data from there. And what has been really helpful for me is joining the genealogy societies, making friends, because I can easily email from another genealogy society and say, hi, I'm a member of XYZ Genealogy Society, and I'm looking into blah, blah, blah. Can you go and pull records from this place? That's one thing that Ancestry.com is really good at. It. If I can't see or read what the record is, I've got a note as to where the record is. Or I can go and then Google it and find out where the record may be and then ask someone from another genealogy society to do that. That has been very helpful. You know, it's like hiring a reader, basically. Sometimes I have to contribute to the genealogy societies in order to make it happen, but a lot of times it's well worth it. So the other tool that has been very helpful for me that I also get through Ancestry.com is looking at other people's family trees. When I find a family who has a blind person in them, I email that family asking for data and information. Probably 10% of the time I actually get a response. That might be a little generous. It might be more like 6%, but I do get a response, and there are times that people have a lot of information they're willing to share. Other times they're not. But that also gives me the color to the people, not just the facts. One of the things that I've discovered is that although we as blind people are researched to death from how much vision we have or don't have, how fast we can or cannot read Braille, how we travel, we are not put into the footprint of research of this country. What I mean by that is, for example, I'm researching somebody right now who I know where they were in 1940. I know that they were attending a school for the blind. I found the parents, but because the blind child was not living with the parents, they were not counted in the census. And to the best of my ability to find the school for the blind in the census, it doesn't seem to be there. When people were working at some of these workshops, boom shops, industrial homes, they might not even have a name. They'd just be a first name and listed as an inmate. So you can't track a person that way very well. There were many poor homes, but they weren't sanctioned by the city or the church or whatever. And a lot of the inmates of these poor farms, poor homes, did not want people to know they were there. And so the names weren't often taken. So it's very hard to sometimes track somebody. I can know a fair amount about someone from a newspaper article, but when I go to vital statistics records, maybe only one entry shows up, no matter how you misspell. They're just not there. So I have to always rely on many different forms of research. Of course, there's always Googling stuff, but what I have learned, as what we all have learned, especially those of us who have done any NFB PR, is that what's printed in the newspaper ain't always right. And so you need at least a second or third backup statistic before you want to use it as a fact. So I do a lot of re-reviewing of my files. What I hope to gain from a lot of this, be nice if I could become rich and famous as an author, but somehow I think my subject matter is just not out there for the masses yet. But what I would like to see happen is that rather than us being studied as a group with no names, that it's looked at what we have done in our lives, what we have accomplished, and that type of information is in classes that are mandatory for people who wish to become rehabilitation counselors, social workers, service providers, medical professionals, aging professionals, because we're too often discouraged because no one has any idea of a workaround technique, or the other blind person has already done that in the past. So that is hopefully what I'm going to get out of my research. I'll have to probably look down from above before I ever see it happen, but if I can start everyone talking about our history, what the average blind person did, that would be terrific. We know that we can't rely on rehabilitation agencies to do it. We know that we can't rely on schools for the blind. I have studied many of the biennial reports of schools for the blind, reports of private institutions for the blind. What I find is that when they highlight in their annual reports a particular someone or memorial or an award that they have given, they'll have the picture and all the biographical data and pages of wonderful things that are said about that person, and they're all cited. They rarely promote their students, their graduates, unless they worked at the school. They don't, if they have alumni events, they might mention that graduates came and shared with them how they made a successful career of XYZ, and they don't mention that blind student who came back. So we aren't even worthy of mention in a lot of the documents that are about us. We're, again, just down to statistics. I thought I would give you a little bit of an example of some of the research that I have been doing. I have probably somewhere about maybe 50 to 75,000 names of blind guys. Some all I have is their name. Some all I have is just they were living in such and so a city in 1895 or something. And some are much more complete. I want to talk to groups and address what's most important to them. So when I'm talking to young kids, I'll talk about jobs like that their parents had or what some blind children did when they were their age. When I talk to seniors, most of the time I talk about people who went blind later in life and what they did. I think that that is far more important to hear, because too often, if a person is successful as well, yeah, but they've been blind since birth or whatever. So I can dispel that myth when I talk to blind seniors. So I went and spoke last week to some blind seniors, and I talked about a few of these people, so I thought I'd sort of recycle them for you guys. One of the interesting blind guys that I can't find a lot about but find him to be very interesting is a guy by the name of Sonny Brooks. He was an actor, by the way. Probably never heard of him. However, if you are a Laurel and Hardy fan or Charlie Chaplin fan, he might have been in some of those talkies. He started out in a silent movie. I should go back further. Sammy was born in 1891, and he died in 1951. He began acting in silent films in 1916. Before that, by the time he was seven, he was on the stage in New York City in many plays, in companies where it was primarily childhood actors. His mother was definitely an actor, supposedly. His father was an actor. Acting was not a, it was not a profession that nice people went into, but people who were very wealthy still went to see that, the plays they were in. So he was an actor. He was also extremely short. Depending on which bio you read about him, he's anywhere from, 3.5 feet to about 4'10". Actually, he was probably more a little over 4 feet. but his facial expressions were priceless. And he had a physical comedy that was also priceless. Now, by the time 1930 rolled around, he had lost a fair amount of vision. He's you know, about 40 years old. This is not necessarily the end of a career. It doesn't have to be for him. But he was a little bit more careful about telling people that he was losing his sight because the talkies had come in. He didn't have the best voice for a leading man, but he was a very comedic actor, so his voice fit many times the comedic part. And he was friends with a lot of these guys, had been working with them in the silent picture days since 1916, so they helped him out. But by 1930, there was just no way to hide it anymore. He lost enough vision. He couldn't read the scripts. He was acting on his energy as opposed to somebody giving him visual direction. He continued to act for several years. In fact, Laurel and Hardy, when they put on their last big movie in 1936, I think it was. The Bohemian Girl, that's what it was, in 1936. They asked for him to be in that movie. He had a speaking part by name. They wanted him there because of his comedic ability. He couldn't speak. He was pretty much totally blind by this time. He did one more feature film, and then he decided it was time to retire. He was heading close to 50. And what he did was he sort of reinvented himself. He knew all about the studio industry, how it all changed from just a little building to multiple blocks and acres of lots. He knew the people. He opened up near the front gates it was much more than a candy stand. He sold some souvenirs and memorabilia and candy and lunch stuff and all that good junk. And he kept that running until he died in 1951. One of the other interesting things about Sammy is that many of the other actors that he worked with, they were not upset by the fact that he was going blind. The management might have been concerned, but not so much the actors. And one actor in the 1920s who had worked on a film with him in one of the leading roles came back to the studio one day and brought him a dog and said, you know, here, I have somebody train this dog to help you get around a little bit. So he used a dog guide for some of his travels. By and large, he didn't use many other techniques at all, unless he went on the arm of someone else. But he had a very successful life and transitioned, which many did not, from the talkies, from the silent movies to the talkies. He managed to make the transition. Was he super wealthy? No. And part of that is blamed on his lifestyle between 1916 and 1925, when he enjoyed life to its fullest, had modest rooms in a hotel near the studio, and enjoyed going out every night and partying. That might also have a little bit more to do with his ill health later on. But that was Sammy. And you have to kind of look hard for old Sammy because he doesn't quite appear in many of the movies that he appeared in. He is given, he's just said as, you know, as a dwarf, as the dwarf played so-and-so. And he's listed as the dwarf, as his name. Like I said, he was really short. And so in many ways, he felt in his lifetime that it was his height that was a curse and an asset, much more than his blindness was. Another interesting person that I have had the pleasure of speaking to a direct descendant from is Charles Frederick Luthy, and everybody called him Fred, so we're just going to call him Fred. He was born in 1894 and died in 1963, and I had the pleasure of interviewing his son. Boothie was the son of a man who fought in the Civil War, had gotten a little bit of money and opportunity to get some open land in the West when they were opening up. Civil War vets got priority for homesteading. So he did some of that, gathered some land. He was a miner. And then after he gets his money, he gets married and he has his family. And along comes old Fred Luthy and a sister. Now, what I actually thought was the coolest is that when we lived in Albuquerque, New Mexico, we lived on the corner of Central and Arno. And he lived on the corner of Railroad and Arno. And Central Avenue used to be known as Railroad Avenue. So he actually lived right across the street from me when I was living there. So I was pretty excited about that. Fred Luthy grew up kind of a privileged kid. Went to high school. He was driving around in one of like the only 10 cars that the city of Albuquerque had. Went to all the society dances. His dad owned lots of property. His dad was part of the industry of banks failing and coming up and failing and coming up. Albuquerque had a long history of that. So when Fred returned from World War One, he went into the banking business in Albuquerque, and he helped to salvage the Albuquerque City Bank and a couple of other banks from going under, merging a few of them, kept them afloat when there was some severe economic stress in Albuquerque. The Depression comes along. He's now vice president of the Albuquerque National Bank, and he's keeping it going. He's managing to keep the community happy with him. He's managing to keep the bank bringing in new customers. He helped other banks when they were dissolving and mostly took their customers, but mostly everybody was very happy about that. This was not like a takeover. Other banks would call in Fred to help smooth this things over, and Fred was willing to come because it meant bringing customers for his bank. So, around about the age of 44, Fred has now started his young family. He got a late start, just like his dad. And he's vice president of the bank. He and the bank president go out with some other investors to rural part of New Mexico where they have money invested in some oil wells. They're going to be shooting the well, and they come out to watch. This is usually not that dangerous of a procedure, but basically there's like this gasoline bomb that they put down the oil, the hole, and blast it open and so on. Unfortunately, while carrying it to the rig, somehow it went off, and it killed 8 people, including the president of the bank. Fred was very seriously hurt and spent a couple of weeks in the hospital and was blind. So what are they going to do? The bank has now lost its president. Fred Luthy, they think, is probably, he's going to be lost to them. But they need to pull the bank through because this is a major crisis. It's during the Depression. They don't want to lose their customer base. People are going to think pulling out of the bank. So they make Fred president of the bank and figured that they, you know, people had confidence in Fred that this would help them get through the rough spot while they found a new president. Well, Fred took this very seriously, being the bank president, and he managed to keep the bank afloat. Then the Second World War breaks out, and all the young men leave, which meant that actually several of the banks in New Mexico went under, because who wants to deal with a woman banker? Well, Fred decided that they would hire women bankers. And they always had a man on duty in case you didn't want to deal with a woman. But he hired women bankers, and he hired women to act in other administrative capacities in the bank as well during the war. When the war was over, some of the women quit, but he did not ask the other women to quit, and the bank kept on growing. Fred reached out when he had first become blind all across the country. He traveled to New York to find the best doctors, talk to people about what he should do as a blind person. I talked with people at the American Foundation for the Blind. He had all this money. He was a rich man in the state of New Mexico, but he had absolutely no place to purchase services. His money did him no good as a blind man. He couldn't purchase better medical care. He could not purchase even library services. But his influence did help in that when he went to the Library of Congress, rather than making him sort of the stepchild in Oklahoma, like some blind people had happened in New Mexico to the Library for the Blind in Oklahoma, he was a member of the Library of Congress on a national level, and therefore received his books directly from the Library of Congress in D.C. So he learned to keep up with his reading and speed up his records, his son said, till they sounded like Donald Duck. I'm sure many of you can understand what that meant. He kept on writing in print. His habits had been for years, for every meeting he attended, to write out his own notes, even if he had a secretary there writing them out. He continued that practice. As president of the bank, he hired a second secretary, and her job was strictly to read onto reel-to-reel. I made the mistake of saying cassettes last week. Read onto reel-to-reel tape, magazines, news clippings, bank magazines, things that came in, correspondence. She read them all. That's all she did all day. And then he'd take it home and read it at night at double speed. His secretaries would transcribe his notes for him, the other secretaries. Sometimes they would sit in meetings. Sometimes they would not. He would walk his customers to the door or from the welcoming desk to his office. And most of the time, people did not know, if they did not know the history of the bank, they did not know that Fred was blind. He used a walking cane, which was fashionable for men at the time, as a cane in front of him. But again, he had no cane training. He had no place to go get cane training. The only option he had, and he did reach out to them, was this volunteer group to aid the blind in Albuquerque. And what they could offer him was that he could work maybe 20 hours a week making brooms. That was all they offered him. He's a bank president, for Pete's sake, and this is all you're going to offer him he can do. So he decided that, you know, he was just going to forge his own way. 25 years passed after that explosion. His bank was the top bank for the state of New Mexico. When he died, he was one of the 25 richest men in the state of New Mexico. His son, who was about 20 at the time when he died, 25 at the time when he passed away.
Podcast download failed. Not enough space on internal memory.
Still doing that.
He went ahead and became president of that same bank like 10, 15 years later. Fred left a legacy to his son. Not that Fred brought him up in the banking industry, although he did in a sense when Fred was a young boy. He wanted to spend more time with his son, so he'd bring his son to work with him on Saturdays. And they would have fun, you know, in the bank because nobody was there. They didn't open the bank on Saturdays. And so his son sort of grew up absorbing the banking business, but he followed his dad in, and like I said, it was like 20-some years later when he became president of the bank himself, so his dad certainly didn't appoint him there. And that was a really neat opportunity to speak with his son, because his son did tell me all of the things that the publications glamorized or overlooked. That that was really cool to actually get a really good feel of who the man was. Oh, another thing is that he claimed to have used the dog guide. Actually, what the dog guide was a rescue animal his son made him keep. It was a Heinz 57 mutt who apparently was one of the ugliest dogs you could ever find in the city of Albuquerque. And his son wanted to take the dog with them to the bank on Saturdays. And the trolley master said, "You can't bring that dog on here." And Fred said, "Well, I'm blind and it's my seeing eye dog." And they let him on. Now, Fred, the son, will tell you that the dog was not reliable at all as a seeing eye dog, but at least it got the dog to the bank for them to have fun time together for the son. Excuse me. Another person that I like to highlight, especially for older people, is a guy from Minnesota, and his name is Clarence Honan. Clarence was born in 1900 and died in 1963. He was not a rich man or a notable man or anything like that, but he was a good, hard-working Minnesota type of guy, don't you know? And excuse me. And he was living the good life in the sense that he was employed. He had gotten married to a lady, and they had three children. He owned his own home. But then, shortly after the birth of his last child, his wife died. He became very depressed. He had a hard time holding a job. He lost his house and had to give his children up to relatives because he couldn't raise them anymore. He moped around and took odd jobs when he can get them. About 6 years later, from the death of his wife, he was blowing out tree stumps. And this is an old-time familiar story. He put the dynamite, lit the dynamite, ran for cover. Dynamite didn't go off. He waited. The dynamite didn't go off. So he gets up, disgusted, runs over, picks up the dynamite. It went off. He lost his hand. He lost much of his hearing, and he lost all of his sight. Now he's really depressed. I mean, if it wasn't for bad luck, this guy truly would have had no luck at all. So he's pretty much homeless. He's got no career. He's got no family to support him. He goes to the summer school program at the Minnesota State School for the Blind, which was a program that started for blind men to hone up on their skills as piano tuners, furniture makers, you name it. He goes to the program, and he's sort of evaluated. They suggest that he become a piano tuner because he's got skills with tools and things like that. Now, Clarence is sitting around thinking, really? I mean, first of all, I wasn't any good at music before I went blind. Second of all, I can't hardly hear it. Thirdly, I have no hand on my right hand. I don't think this is a career for me. But what he got out of that summer program was contact with a bunch of other blind guys who told him not to give up, find something that you can do, work with your hands, because that's what you like to do. So one of the blind guys said to him, "You know what? In Minneapolis, there's this blind guy. He owns a big broom factory. He employs a lot of blind and sighted guys. Why don't you go talk to him?" So he did. Now, the depression is just starting. Minneapolis isn't hit too hard, but it's still being hurt. And he goes up to the guy and he says, I'd like to work as a salesman for your broom factory. I don't think I could wind the brooms, but I'd like to work as a salesman." And he said, "Well, you know, my district here in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, that's tight. I can't really support another salesman here. But if you could find a way to work out into the country, that would be terrific. So he finds this other guy who's sighted and who's out of work, doesn't really have a place to live. They buy this beat-up old truck that's held together with baling wire and bubble gum, and they go to the broom factory, and they buy a whole load of brooms, fill the back end, and head out for western Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and they sell all the brooms. So they turn around, go back, buy another truck load, go back out. They're living in their trucks. They're living in the truck, so they don't have any living expenses for, like, hotels or anything like that. And within a couple of years, he saved up enough money where he buys a house, and he does what we today call flipping. He buys a bigger house, flips it, buys some more houses. He's living in one and repairing others. And he's got enough money now as a broom salesman where he can get at least two of his children back because one was adopted out. He gets his mother to come live with him, who is now a widow, and she cares for the children while he goes out on the road. And, again, he keeps getting more houses and flipping them, and pretty much he's not having to go out on the road as much. Then in the 1940s, he's changing the windows. They have to change the storm windows and screens in Minnesota. And he's climbing up the ladder. He's only got one hand, so one hand is holding on the ladder and the other one is balancing the window, and he's changing it and thinking to himself, you know what, I'm getting too old for this. There's got to be a better way. He goes to a blind guy who builds furniture and is telling him about his idea of this window that you could bring in, pull out, wash, put back, change the screen, all from the inside. He's got the idea of the mechanism. So the two of them built the window, and Clarence shops it around. He gets a patent on it, and when he sells off the patent, he never has to work again. This was one of the best things, he says, that happened to him, was becoming blind, because it turned his life around. He went through hell for a few years, but he ended up having his children back with him. He got married again and enjoyed life to its fullest. Those are some examples of some of the blind folks that I talk about, especially when I'm talking with seniors. But I thought what I'd do is I'd give you guys a little time to maybe ask some questions about what I do or some of the guys I talked about.
This is Shelley. I think that's very fascinating. I just love hearing stories like that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, these are the Pollyanna ones. I've been accused of being too much of a Pollyanna. So I put out a story in my emails for June. I have a monthly email list, and if you want to be on it, you can just give me your email address, and I'll put you on it. But my June email was about a man from Minnesota who escaped from prison and took two children hostage, and the SWAT team took the guy out, the blind guy out, just as he was bringing a knife to the little girl's throat. They did not see him as a blind guy, although his wife was on TV. Oh, this happened in the 80s, so I remember this. His wife is on TV saying, "Don't shoot him, don't hurt him, he's a blind guy, he couldn't hurt anybody." Now, the thing is, Mr. Hill was in prison for murdering his girlfriend just before the wedding.
Nice.
He had married this woman while in prison. He had several relationships with women, mostly as pen pals, which is how this woman was picked as the person who they were going to go to for help when Larry escaped. His name was Larry Hill. When Larry escaped from prison. And it was her children they took hostage. This guy had a girlfriend and his wife, and he's murdered another girlfriend, and he had a long history of being in jail. The cops did not see him as a blind guy who they could deal with. They saw a hardened, murderous criminal who would kill those children in a heartbeat if they gave him a chance. So they took him out, and they did not apologize for it. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I have this email list. And if you are interested, I will be glad to put you on it. I write for Dialogue Magazine. I do the history column for Dialogue Magazine. And I've submitted a couple of articles for the Braille Monitor. I've written for several magazines now about blind history. So please look for mine and share them when you can.
Peggy, this is Ruth. I just share a funny little thing with you. But I was reading a book on cloth and how different cloth became... you know why people used it way back 30,000 years ago in modern times. But in one of the records, it did say that in the court of Darius, there was a blind weaver, and she got paid the same wages as the other weavers. And I thought that was pretty cool. Yeah. If you're weaving for the palace, you're pretty good.
Absolutely.
That's the first instance of I've read in just something about a blind person when I was reading another topic, you know, but I thought that was... So, yeah, we've been around a long time doing a lot of different things.
And there are times people do not put in news articles or books about us as a blind person because it might be too difficult for the reader to believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not necessarily noted if that blind person was fairly well-known in their area.
Peggy, this is Monsieur Renaud. There are two people in Baltimore that I'll give you. One I know the name of is an uncle of mine who became blind in later life. The other one, I don't remember his name, became a real estate, I can't think of it right. Not a real estate agent, but the other, beyond that, you know, having a real estate company. I'll get his name, and you can look them up. I can give you my uncle's name and get the phone numbers of his stores. He's since passed, and he didn't become blind. He had RP and didn't become blind until later in life.
Well, this is good.
So I'll get you that information.
You can reach me. My email is theblindhistorylady@gmail.com.
I'm a dinosaur. I don't use email. But I'll see you at convention.
You will indeed.
I'm sorry?
You will indeed.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll have that up in the Colorado delegation.
Okay. And of course, I'll be in the Maryland delegation.
Any other questions that people have?
I think you covered well how you find the people, which is interesting, and the records and using the genealogy sites. I wouldn't have thought of that. So that's interesting.
Well, the neat part was, you know, I put all this stuff aside, but when I was doing my family genealogy, if you get into a newspaper and you find a particular article, you need some basis of understanding, and the newspaper article doesn't always give that to you, but if you read around it, what else is in that edition of the paper, you can get a little more grounding as to what was going on in the community at the time, or why it was that nobody could buy grain seed or what have you. And I would often find articles about such and so blind person was awarded money from the county, or such and so blind person is in town tuning pianos or whatever, and I'd take those little snippets out. Sometimes there'd be wonderful articles about blind people, which kept adding it to my collection and gave me the idea of going through and approaching this as if they were my ancestor.
Peggy, this is Susie.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you should tell us how we can go about reading your books.
Okay, oh, that's another thing. Okay, so I've also published about 11 books on Smashwords. I'm self-published. And if you go to www.smashwords.com, and of course it's a www dot, you know, smashwords.com, and you either search for Peggy Chong or Blind History Lady or whatever, my books will come up. They are put on Smashwords in a variety of different formats. I suggest that you either pull a text version or a Word version, not an EPUB version or a Kindle version, unless you have a Kindle, but pull the Word or the text version of the book. They're meant to be text versions. I don't put in a lot of drawings or charts or anything like that because I want the conversion to be clean. I have books up there about John Swearingen, who was refused entrance to public schools in South Carolina and became the superintendent of education for 14 years. I have a book about John Hershoff, the blind boat builder. I have books of the first book I put up is called The First Things I Learned. And it covers a lot of the articles that I wrote for the Minnesota Bulletin, some of the people that I knew back in the Minnesota days, and some other short stories about a couple of other blind people that I had early research on. This was the basis for my research. So go to smashwords.com, and you can download my books.
Wonderful.
That's cool. Dialogue Magazine is a subscription magazine, correct?
Correct, yes. It's $25 or $35 a year, if I remember right. And I have been publishing now for 6 years, the history column. I'm thankful for B.T. Kimbrough to, he wasn't really sure I could come up with enough articles to write about, but I've kept him satisfied, so.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much, Peggy, for taking the time to speak with us. I think we found it very enjoyable. And I guess I should say, is there any way that we can help you do this research? Is there some things that we should, you know, we could do to help you? I mean, giving you names for sure, but...
Giving me names, that's a really big help. As I say, I have lists of names, mm-hmm. but I can tell you that what your name was as a child is not the same as what it was as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ladies that I started to investigate about 10, 12 years ago, was from Iowa. And she had an interesting story, but she never told much about the details of her background. She talked about having to go overseas to marry, and then he died, and that's how she ended up in Iowa. Because it was focused on her Slate and Stylus collection that she had and what she was doing with her life in Iowa. Anyway, after moving here to Colorado, I stumbled across a newspaper clipping. And it was that same lady. She turns out she's born and raised here in Colorado. So I have been able to do a lot of research about her, but I did not have her maiden name. You know, I had her first married name, but that doesn't help you find somebody before that marriage. And they were married in England, so there was no way to get the marriage license from England to find out where she had been living and so on, so... So you just never know. Sometimes it may seem like an insignificant piece of information, and then yet, there again, you never know. The NFB the Springfield chapter in Boston has been very helpful to me in finding information about Anita O'Shea, a blind lady who was one of the first women board members of the National Federation of the Blind in the 1950s. And they didn't always realize what they were telling me was very helpful, but it was. They got me the names of her reader. They got me the names of her cousins, and I was able to find them and email back and forth with them and got a whole lot of information, because I want these people to be real. I don't want them to be just statistics. I want them to speak to us. I want them to tell us what techniques they used or didn't use. Did they have blindness training or did they not? One gentleman right now that I'm researching, also the Tennessee School for the Blind, kind of says he's a graduate, but he have to read between the lines because he never really was a graduate. They were very proud of him, so they quietly claimed him as their own.
Okay. Does anybody have any other comments or questions or anything for Peggy?
So, Miss Peggy, it's Robert here. So, what methods, blindness methods, you know, like, do you use a note taker at all, you know, like a braille with a braille display? Do you just do all this on a laptop, on a, just what kind of combination of technology do you use?
I use a variety of things. And one of the things I found out curiously is that if you take a photograph of a page with an iPhone or an iPad, especially some of this older stuff that's kind of faded or the paper's icky, it actually makes it easier to scan it than the original. So I use JAWS. I use an iPhone, an iPad, because they're a lot easier to get into a library. I use Kurzweil. I use another scanning option Curtis put on my computer, which I can't remember the name of right now, that is great for text. So I use a variety of things, but mostly I think the thing that is the best tool I have is the ability to interview people and ask them about their ancestors, get the information from them. And sometimes that takes a while. You have to go back and revisit. But it's amazing what I find out and how the successful blind people, mostly, every time I think there's a definite pattern to the success of the blind or whatever, I find some other people that just shoot it out of the water. So, but most of them had other blind people to use as a resource in some way, shape, or form, whether it was a formal friendship or just someone they could go to, ask for advice, whether it was they were a graduate of a school for the blind or a rehabilitation program of some sort. And back in the 1880s, 1870s, you're talking about a broom shop or an industrial home or something like that. But they did, back then, a lot more of keeping track of each other and working with each other to support each other when they were out in all these rural communities. Sometimes those those letters that kept circulating back and forth, the Braille letters that many blind people had with their groupings of friends, were the best rehabilitation options that a lot of these folks had. And sometimes you have to go and find somebody who can dig out and see if some of those letters are in their files and give them to you, and actually some families have. So it's kind of interesting to see that kind of support that they had for each other firsthand rather than just kind of reading about it in a book.
Well, if there are no other questions, I want to thank you so much, Peggy. And we'll see you this summer at convention.
You betcha.
As well.
Hooray.
I think it's very interesting. And maybe at convention, other people will have, you know, some leads for you, too, or information. So you never know.
You never know.
So I want to
She's
going to
come to our meeting, right?
Yes, she is.
And do you know when our meeting is going to be yet?
Well, I know when. I don't know where. I don't know the room number. It's going to be Tuesday, July 9th at the, you know, usual time of 1 o'clock. Right. So 12:30 registration, 1 o'clock meeting. But I don't know the room.
Okay.
Well, thank everybody for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, our next call will be Tuesday, July 2nd. So that's our last call of this spring. So thank you all very much, and thank you, Peggy, again. And Robert, thank you for using your Victor, and I hope it worked.
There's something I need to learn about it more, so that it worked. It's working fine.
Yes. Okay, good. Thank you all. Have a good evening, everyone.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks, Ms. Peg.
Bye-bye.